Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 3, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got three segments scheduled for tonight. First of all, I'll speak with Bill Fletcher of the Trans-Africa Forum, but also one of the lead organizers of United for Peace and Justice, about what's ahead for the peace movement. And then about 20 minutes after, we'll speak with Rod Al-Qadiri, who is the manager of country risk analysis at PFC Energy, which is the former Petroleum Finance Corporation, about Iraq and oil and how those things are all related to the war. And then finally, at about 5:40, we'll speak with Bathsheba Crocker, who is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, about a report that she co-authored a couple of months ago that's written up in today's New York Times, A Wiser Peace and Action Strategy for a Post-Conflict Iraq, What is Planned for Iraq After the War is Over, assuming that the war is ever over. And since it's a full show, let's I want to say that tomorrow morning brings the release of the monthly U.S. employment report, which is, for many reasons, probably the most important economic report the government regularly puts out. It's the best measure of how ordinary folks are doing in this economy, but it's also a very timely picture of how the economy most broadly is doing. So it's if you have to look at just one monthly indicator, that's really the one to look at. And expecting a not-so-good report, whether it's a combination of whether it's the war, whether it's underlying economic problems, or a combination of the two, the United States economy does not seem to be recovering from its recession, and actually, if anything, seems to be taking another dip into the red ink. So we will see tomorrow morning, but probably talk about this next week, but things are not very good with the U.S. economy right now. And, of course, all our president and our leaders can care about is destroying another country. And now we're joined by Bill Fletcher, who is with the Trans-Africa Forum, but also one of the organizers with United Peace for Peace and Justice. Welcome to WBAI, Bill Fletcher.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
So let me start before I ask you about the peace movement specifically, or the anti-war movement. What do you think this war is about? Is it about oil? I assume you don't think it's about liberating the people of Iraq. So is it about oil? Is it about a grand imperial plan? What's the thinking behind it, do you think?
I think it's about both of those. I think that it's about distracting people in the United States from what's going on here. I think it's about securing the oil. I think it's about competition with Europe around the euro. And I definitely think it's about attempting to restructure the Middle East in, or Western Asia, as it should be called, to conform to U.S. and Israeli objectives.
Well, that's a pretty complex set of reasons. So how does a peace movement organize against something like that?
I think that one of the things that we and others have been saying from the beginning is to concentrate on the illegality of this war, which I think is something that we cannot tire of raising before the public, that this is a war of aggression, and that's not simply a rhetorical statement. It is an illegal war. It has no backing from anybody, and what the Bush administration is doing with their puppy dog Blair is that they are reconstructing the whole notion of international relations in a completely self-serving way that from the standpoint of the average person in the United States should be very worrisome.
Now, the United States has committed many wars of aggression over the last 100, 150 years, and certainly many in the last 50 or 75 in the pursuit of a specifically imperial mission. Is there something different about this?
I think that there is and there isn't. I think that's an excellent point that you raise. I think that what's different is actually the context and the philosophy that's driving this, which I would suggest to you is what is so unsettling, the Germans, the French, the Russians, and the Chinese, that the issuing of the national security doctrine in the fall of 2002 really sets out a different ideological or philosophical notion about what should be driving U.S. foreign policy. They have ripped away all of the pretense of democracy. They are completely ignoring and marginalizing, at best marginalizing, the United Nations. I think that that's the brazen nature of the Bush administration's approach on this is what's different. And the fact that they have been willing to shatter alliances that they've had for 50 years with critical nations, I think is also what makes this different.
Now, you mentioned the illegality is an important thing to focus on, and you know, some people would regard that as just liberal fussiness and not something you can really fight in, or try to resist imperial domination with. You think it's so? It's pretty crucial to any kind of anti-war.
I do. I think it's critical on a number of levels. One is that it speaks to some of the very basic concerns that many people have. I mean, I could certainly elaborate a full anti-imperialist critique of what's going on, but at the level of an anti-war movement where you're actually trying to stop this aggressive action from taking place and you're trying to influence millions of people, one of the things we have to speak to is the doubt that so many people in this country have, which I think I would contend are still evident in the polls. People have a very basic doubt about what the Bush administration is doing. And they've been able to, the Bush administration has been relatively successful in suppressing that by a rally around the flag boys attitude, particularly since the bullets started flying. But I think that that basic doubt is something that we have to speak to. So the question of illegality is also a matter of setting precedent. I think that that's something that everyone has to be very concerned about.
Well, the precedent in this case is, I mean, a lot of people have remarked on, and certainly I've been talking about this in the show for close to a year now, that this is really the first step in a long plan of global transformation.
That's right.
So I mean, how can you make that point to a broad audience? Certainly this war may wind down in several weeks. Who knows what's going to happen? It could go on forever.
Right.
Who knows? But,
right.
it may end up as the administration hoped, more or less. How do you make the point to a broader public that this is only the beginning of a long struggle?
Well, one of the things is I think that we use the Bush administration's documents against them. I think that it's important that people understand that much of the thinking, the policy thinking that went into this has been developing over the last 12 years. And there's a paper trail that outlines very clearly what the political right that is in office right now has sought to do. So I think that's critically important that people see that right in front of them.
Do you think we'd be at war now if Gore had, I guess he won the election, but actually
right.
he had been inaugurated?
I've asked myself that question. I tend to think not at least in Iraq. I think that if Gore had been elected, that probably the war with Afghanistan would have taken place, and there might have been some slim differences, but I think that probably would have happened. I'm not convinced that we would be at war with Iraq right now. I think that there was a basic notion of containment, and I'm not justifying containment, but I think that was the basic approach that they were prepared to take. But this administration found itself in a complicated situation, one being that it needed something this past summer to keep people's minds off of everything that was going on domestically. I'm absolutely convinced of that, because there was nothing that happened objectively this past summer in Iraq or in the Persian Gulf that would have justified this kind of buildup. So I think that we have to look at that cynicism that has put us in the situation where so many thousands of people's lives are in danger.
Now, the peace movement has been to many demonstrations over the last several months, and it's extremely broad in its demographic and its apparent political leanings. How do you handle this? I mean, there are some people who are just church-going liberals who are just outraged by the brazenness and illegality of this particular war. There are some, really hardcore radicals who are appalled by the imperial plan. I mean, how do you talk to all those people and keep this together as a coherent movement?
Well, I think that's a critical point. We are attempting to broaden the movement constantly while at the same time having certain key messages. The reality of the anti-war movement is that it is both a movement, but it's also a collection of movements. There are several different anti-war coalitions that, for the most part, are getting along better than many of us would have expected years ago. And I think that that's great, and it's a tribute to the maturity that we've undergone, as well as a tribute to the crisis that we're in. So I think that part of it is having very clear messages. The other thing is recognizing that there are certain issues where we're not going to have agreement. Within the anti-war movement, there remains a debate around the question of Israel and Palestine. There's no question about that. In United for Peace and Justice, we have been definitely talking about this Palestinian question, and we will continue, and I will definitely continue to raise this as central to the resolution of any peace in the Middle East. There are others in the anti-war movement that disagree with this formulation and do not want to talk about whether it's Palestine or Venezuela. I think that we have to recognize that the movement has to be broad enough to contain those various forces. That's the only way that we'll actually be able to influence at the level of power. That's the challenge that faces us, because what we don't want to be, at least I don't think we want to be, is simply a protest movement. It's not about having one more demonstration or calling one before someone else does. Ultimately, this is about power.
I'm speaking with Bill Fletcher, who is one of the organizers, of the principal organizers with United for Peace and Justice, and also with the Trans-Africa Forum based in Washington, D.C. Now, in an effort to appeal to this broad movement, some people are throwing around slogans like peace is patriotic, support the troops by bringing them home. Some of that makes me a little nervous, but maybe I'm just an old dinosaur. I mean, is this dangerous or is this a good strategy? Does it start risking conceding too much to the flag-waving forces?
I think it depends on the context. In other words, if someone says to me, you're not supporting the troops, I feel very comfortable saying in response, I'm supporting them by wanting them home immediately. So it's a question of the context, and it needs to be looked at tactically. I do not think that we should treat this at the level of principle. I think, with the issue of patriotism, that there is a debate that is worthwhile having with forces on the right. When they are attempting to bait us and say that we are, off the ranch or that we are unpatriotic, I think that there's a challenge that must be fought, because the issue is not what Bill Fletcher thinks. The issue is, how do we get to the middle? The people, the average person in the United States who may have those doubts about this war, those are the people that we have to be influencing. So that's why I'm not prepared to enter into a major debate at the level of principle. I may have my reservations about certain things, but I think we have to figure out, or let me put it a different way, that for that person in the middle who may be concerned about the issue of patriotism, I think it's completely appropriate to say that a definition of patriotism, at least according to most dictionaries I look at, is a love of one's country, not unconditional support of the administration in power and their objectives, irrespective of the social costs. I think that that's a debate that we must have.
And then also that how, into this context, we introduce, if not the word, the analytical concept of imperialism.
Well, I think that the open discussions of imperialism has become, since the Cold War, but particularly over the last 2 years, have become much easier than any time that I can ever remember. I mean, we have the official media debating the notion of empire and what should be the scope of the U.S. empire. So I think that it's this is a very good time for us to be, we in the anti-war movement, and particularly those of us on the left, for us to be talking about this issue of imperialism, and that imperialism is not simply about the bad behavior of the Bush administration with regard to Iraq. It's about what happens domestically. It's about monopoly capitalism. It's about the attempts to overthrow duly elected leaders like President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. So I think we can have that discussion right now in a way that very difficult in previous years.
Yeah, I guess the pro-imperialists are out there injecting the word into the discourse. So
absolutely. Very open.
They can take their lead. And how about tying this vast foreign agenda to issues of domestic repression? I mean, how deeply should the peace movement get into that?
It's critical. It's critical to talk about domestic repression as well as the economic situation. You know, just working backwards, the economic situation, is, as you well know, is just like unraveling. And people are suffering. We have virtually every state, if not every state, in deep, deep financial trouble. Yet this administration wants $75 billion for the destruction of another country. And this is something that resonates.
And they don't want to pay for, you know, homeland security either. They just want to pay for foreign wars.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I think that the issue of domestic repression must be elevated. And the danger with regard to many people's lack of sense of urgency about this, I'm talking about at the everyday level, is that people will say, well, I don't have anything to worry about. I'm not going to commit any crimes. And so I think that that's why it's important to talk about the ramifications of the USA Patriot Act, of the proposed amendments to the USA Patriot Act. People have to relate this to their own experiences. And again, this has to be part of what the anti-war movement addresses, that we are, in fact, a movement for democracy, for democracy at the level of foreign policy as well as for democracy internally.
And finally, how optimistic are you? I mean, the polls show strong support for the president, but not like what we saw 10 years ago in the previous Gulf War. Do you feel like you're pushing up a stone up a hill, or is
not at all? I don't feel isolated in the least, and I'm not smoking anything either. I mean, I think that this is a very interesting time. The polls I treat with sort of a grain of salt. In the beginning of any war, you're going to have a certain kind of support for the war. It's very predictable, virtually every war. So the polls right now are, in my opinion, fundamentally meaningless. I'm optimistic because I have not seen, and in fact, historically, there has not been an anti-war movement that started and grew at the scale that this grew since World War I, at least in the United States. So we're walking into this with a substantial base in the population. And, you know, I keep running into regular people, cab drivers, you know, people in meetings, in hotels, that look at, and their basic question is about the White House. The lights are on. Is anybody home?
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Bill Fletcher. Thanks for all the good work you're doing. And,
thank you.
We'll be back in touch pretty soon.
Sounds like a plan.
Keep on top of this. All right. Bill Fletcher is one of the principal organizers with United for Peace and Justice and also with the Trans-Africa Forum based in Washington, D.C. And I'm going to take a little musical break, but I want to say before I do that the music on this program will be coming all from a website. The Sonic Youth, Chumbawamba, Cat Power, all kinds of indie and arty pop stars. I've collected some anti-war songs there. And the URL for that is protest-records.com. That's protest-records.com with a hyphen between the two. And let's listen to this excerpt from Sonic Youth's Youth Against Fascism.
Yeah, that's his work. It's the song.
And again, that was Sonic Youth, an excerpt from their song Youth Against Fascism from 1992, I believe. And that, like all the other music on this program, is downloadable in MP3 form from www.protest-records.com. Protest-records.com. And now we're joined by Rod Al-Khadiri, who is a country risk analyst with the PFC Energy, which used to be Petroleum Finance Corporation. And welcome to WBAI.
Hello.
What happened to the Petroleum Finance Corporation? Did you transform into PFC Energy?
Absolutely. Nothing more than that.
Ah, just a name change.
Absolutely.
Let me start with the blunt and vulgar question. Is this a war about oil?
Absolutely not. I think it's a war in some senses that's more fundamental in its aims than just being about oil or controlling oil. I know there's a lot that is said about the Bush administration being full of oil executives, et cetera, or former oil executives, and with its great links to the oil industry. But I think that misses the fact that the Bush administration also has a lot of ideologues in it who have a vision of how they would like to see the world and how they would like to see the Middle East, and are very, very committed to pursuing that vision and committed to pursuing an ideological agenda. And the war in Iraq is very much about that.
But they wouldn't be focusing on the part of the world if it didn't have oil, right?
I think that is possibly true, but I think they wouldn't be focusing on this part of the world if there hadn't been September the 11th. Would probably be closer to the truth. Iraq has been seen as a problem for some time. Iraq has been seen as a rogue state. It's been seen as a state that has been able to challenge U.S. authority, and is in some senses for the Republicans at least unfinished business from 1991. Where oil is important, and I think it's important to realize this, where oil is important to the administration is as a vehicle for change. What they truly believe is that Iraq can be the first step in a series of domino changes that will affect the whole of the Middle East and that will transform it, allowing reform to take place, allowing liberal reformist voices to emerge, and something that will transform the region from being one that is threatening to being one that is a key ally of the United States. And the way that they see oil is doing that is that if you have Iraqi oil on the market, if you have a new Iraq, one where there's a great deal of foreign investment in the industry and production expands significantly and expands to the 6 million barrels a day, the mythical 6 million barrels a day that a lot of people talk about, that you're going to be able to bring the structure of oil prices down, and that that's going to force economic and with it political reform throughout the rest of the region.
Well, now, if oil prices come down too much, that certainly wouldn't be good for George Bush's home state of Texas. Do they really want – is it in the interests of the U.S. to bring oil prices down significantly?
It depends what you mean by significantly. I think if you're talking about bringing oil prices down to the levels that you saw in 1998, obviously, and early 1999, obviously U.S. industry was hit as hard and probably harder than many of the industries elsewhere in the world by that, just simply because you have very mature production in this country. But nonetheless, I think it's an idea of bringing oil prices down sort of into the high teens. The industry here could certainly survive with that, but it would put significant fiscal pressure and significant financial pressure on a lot of governments throughout the Middle East.
And what would be the point of that be, to bring them to their knees?
To bring them to their knees maybe a harsh way of putting it, but certainly to force change upon them. Certainly to put them under significant economic pressure and force significant structural reform on these countries, and the belief being that if you reform the economy and certainly if you move to a system where you require greater taxation or at least greater participation even by the private sector in a number of oil producing states, that there has to be some political quid pro quo involved in that.
Do you think this is a plausible scheme?
I don't. I think, you know, it is founded on the fact initially that you're going to create this beacon of light in Iraq, this democratic model that is going to stand there as an example to the rest of the region. And I think the administration is already discovering that, you know, the Iraqis would like to have some say in their future, and certainly being told how they're going to live their future and being occupied may not be in the agenda of all Iraqis. It's possibly going to be a very difficult place to occupy and run over the next few months and possibly into the next few years. And I think, you know, that challenge will keep the administration focused and will keep the administration's attention, never mind trying to change the rest of the region.
Yeah, I was going to say that they seem to have a long list of countries they want to take on after they handle Iraq. Are they going to be able to get to point two, or is point one going to take them much longer than they thought?
I think point one is already proven to be, politically at least, a little more complicated than they thought. Only time will tell. I think that there are some tough battles that are ahead. You still have to take Baghdad. You still have to oust the regime, and that, you know, while a lot of progress has been made over the last couple of days in terms of military progress, there's still some hard fighting to be done. I would suggest, and there's certainly some hard politicking to be done to win the peace afterwards, and that's going to be a very big challenge. And the administration doesn't have a great deal of time. I mean, it has the rest of this year, and moving into next year, there's a presidential election. That it's going to focus its attention, and this administration, as many others before it, recognized that for re-election, the key is going to be the domestic economy and domestic issues, not foreign policy.
And, of course, the fact that oil prices are hovering around $30 a barrel has not been good for our economy.
The impact of high oil prices on the U.S. economy is I think, is a lot less direct than it maybe was 25, 30 years ago, but nonetheless, high oil prices obviously don't help. You know, it's clear that when the prices were in the mid-30s and above, as they were earlier this year, there was worries in the Fed that it was having a significant impact on, or it was having an impact on inflation. But prices below $30 a barrel probably won't bother the administration. I think they're comfortable with that politically. But nonetheless, they'll be worried anytime prices spike above that.
I'm speaking with Rod Al-Qadiri, who is with the Petroleum Finance Corporation, formerly the Petroleum Finance Corporation, now the PFC Energy Consultancy, based in Washington, D.C. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, your radio voice for peace and justice, and also on the web at WBAI.org, and check out the newly revamped website. Lots of new features and frequent updating, and check it out. And let me ask you again, back to some oil economics. There's a theory circulating on the Internet, where many theories circulate, that the Bush administration decided to go to war with Iraq because they wanted to price oil in euros and not dollars, and the United States just didn't like this. This seems kind of nuts to me, but what do you think of this theory?
I think you just described it in the words that I would have used. I think nuts is probably right. There are a lot of conspiracy theories going around. Again, I mean, I would reiterate the point that I made earlier. It's important to understand what this administration is trying to achieve. I mean, this administration is pursuing an ideological objective. War, oil comes into that, obviously. But this is an ideological objective designed to change the world. There's a feeling in this administration that if the rest of the world had an American varnish on it, would be a far less dangerous place. And in many ways, the Middle East and the Arab world and the Islamic world is being seen in much the same light that the communist world was in the 1970s and the 1980s. And there's a belief that, you know, similar tactics, very muscular foreign policy, and a very rigid commitment to a certain set of principles, and a need to push those principles very hard, are what is going to guarantee U.S. security, and ultimately what is going to guarantee peace and security internationally. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that, but that is the belief in this administration, and it's important to realize that this isn't just about money, deals, and contracts with friends.
Now, going into this, I thought these beliefs that you just outlined were held by a fairly narrow portion of the political elite, and were not really emerging out of American business interests and pundits and, you know, the intellectual class. That was really an obsession of a relatively narrow stratum of our society. Do you see that, or is this really much more broadly adhered to?
I think certainly in terms of a lot of the business community, and particularly the international business community that has international experience in this country, I think there's a recognition of some of the dangers of those policies. It is, and obviously a group particularly that's been very powerful within the administration, the hawks and the neoconservatives that sort of hold sway in the Department of Defense and are important in the Office of the Vice President and have an important voice in the White House itself. And I think, you know, President George Bush has been open to seeing the world through their eyes. And I think he perceives the world as being a very dangerous place out there, and sort of has a faith in U.S. power and U.S. power to change things. So I think it may be narrowly held, but it's a very powerful group, and a group that learnt very quickly that if you set the agenda and you create facts on the ground, if you will, you can push policy and dominate policy, and that's what they have done. That is how, in a sense, they pushed the administration towards this confrontational policy with Iraq, and ultimately I think it's how they'll push post-war policy.
And you work for an energy consultancy. What do the people in the oil business think of this war, and how do they feel about the prospects for prospecting in Iraq?
I can't talk for the energy industry, or at least the sort of the people I deal with, but I think the sense that I get in terms of your second question, at least, is that there is something that needs to be understood, I think, but by a lot of listeners who will perceive this as a war for oil. Actually, the oil companies are well aware that there are a lot of prospects in Iraq, that, you know, it's a very oil-rich environment, and potentially it's going to be open to international investment. But oil companies, while they're willing to take risks, don't like throwing money down the drain. And they're going to want to know a certain number of things before they're going to invest billions of dollars to build up the Iraqi oil industry in the future. They're going to want to know what the contractual terms are going to be. They're going to want to know what the constitutional issues that surround ownership of oil, constitutional issues to do with, is Iraq going to be a federal state or otherwise, constitutional issues to do with, you know, can they guarantee that 3, 4, 5 years down the line there isn't going to be nationalization again? So they want to know that these things are settled before they start putting a lot of money into Iraq. And they'll want to see political stability. Again, this is not offshore. This is not a situation even like you have in Algeria, where you could have a civil war going on for a number of years and the oil fields lying in the desert and away from population centers. The Iraqi oil fields lie very close to some very sensitive flashpoints in the country, and ones that in the future could be very unstable. So I think they're going to want to know what their environment is, what environment they're going into is going to be before they start putting a lot of money into it.
Now, a lot of people think that once, assuming that the war ends the way the administration hopes, that once Tommy Franks is the proconsul of Iraq, then they're going to start handing out oil concessions or even ownership of the oil to ExxonMobil. Is that likely to happen? I mean, who's going to own Iraqi oil when this is all over?
Again, I think that puts your you put your finger on precisely the issue that oil companies want to wait and see. You know, there is still international law that has to be looked at. The U.S. isn't going to be able to just go in there and take over the oil fields and start handing them out willy-nilly. International law will be one reason why not. I think,
but
you know, there is going to be an issue of, you know, the legality of any contracts that are handed out. But also the administration is talking about, you know, integrating Iraqis into whatever new civil administration that they're putting in place, and that it is about to open up a can of worms that's probably going to complicate this whole task. They're talking about federalism. They're talking about how you deal with the various ethnic groups in Iraq, without possibly realizing the complexity of the country, that the mosaic of different groups that exist within these broader groups that they tend to point to, and the whole issue of drawing up a new constitution that deals with precisely this issue of ownership. So on the one hand, you have difficulties in terms of running Iraq over the next few years. On the other hand, as I say, oil companies are going to be reluctant to start putting too much money in until they know what their environment is going to be over a 10, 15-year period, because that's what they look at in terms of making investments.
Now, there's also a theory around that this is the part of what this grand scheme is about is to privatize the now state-owned oil resources of the Middle East, to bring back the old days when it was owned by the Seven Sisters. Is that likely? Is that in their mind?
You have a number of issues that are being thrown around right now. I mean, you have sort of proposals anywhere from privatization that's particularly popular amongst neoconservatives and a lot of conservatives in Washington, right the way through to an appreciation that the Iraqis have always, I mean, oil has always been very important in terms of Iraqi nationalism, in terms of Iraqi patriotism, and it's been a thread that has sort of been constant in Iraq's dealings with the international community and international powers. It was important in terms of leading up to the revolution in 1958 that overthrew the monarchy. And it's something that the Iraqis are very, very proud of in terms of their sector, in terms of a sector that they built up, and they regard it as their own national resource. Those are issues that, again, will be worked out as the politics and as the dynamics of a post war Iraq are settled, and it'll take time, and nothing is very clear right now. But I think there are a lot of Iraqis who would react rather vehemently if you told them that their industry was about to be privatized or at least all handed over to the Seven Sisters.
And finally, you're a specialist in country risk analysis, so let me ask you, is this war making the region more risky or less risky?
A little bit of both. There's a nice equivocal answer for you. I think on the one hand, you know, it's given some of the plans that the administration has put forward for running Iraq and given how unprepared it does seem to be in terms of the post-war winning of the peace and it's setting up effective administrations, I think there's a possibility that Iraq will be a more unstable place than certainly it has been for even the last 10, 12 years. For the region as a whole, I think the region is going to look at the problems that the United States has had in terms of some of the political miscalculations it's made in Iraq thus far, and also some of the problems that it anticipates the United States is going to have dealing with Iraq moving forward, and breathe a sigh of relief, because this idea of, you know, the U.S. moving on to other targets and this idea that, you know, it can transform the region will be less practical. So in an ironic sense, it could lead to a more stable region with a rather unstable Iraq in the middle of it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Rod Al-Qadiri is the is a manager of country risk analysis at PFC Energy, based in Washington, D.C. And we'll be back in a moment after this word from Chumbawamba.
Like the salmon on the mountain, says the drama got to come. Pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of the Father, maybe, but not in my name. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
That was an excerpt from Chumbawamba's Jacob's Ladder, Not in My Name, and like all the other music we're hearing on this program is available from protest-records.com, and all downloadable in MP3 form. And now this is the final segment of Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the show and the station WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And as I said before, be sure to check out the snazzy website. It's now full of stuff and frequently updated and well worth frequent visits. And now we're joined by Bathsheba Crocker, who is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, also in D.C., very D.C.-centered program tonight. But I guess that's the center of the world these days. And she's the co-author of a report, along with Frederick Barton, called A Wiser Peace, an Action Strategy for a Post-Conflict Iraq, which was published in January before the war, but now, of course, is especially relevant, assuming that the war ever comes to an end. Welcome to WBAI, Bathsheba Crocker.
Thank you.
So in your report from several months ago, you had urged that any planning for a post-war Iraq be well advanced before the war began. Has that happened?
It's happened on some fronts and not on others. We've actually done an updated version of the report, which was released last week, to do a sort of scorecard as to where the administration's planning is. In some areas, they've done some considerable planning. They have put together this so-called government in waiting that is sitting in Kuwait City ready to go in, and although it's causing some controversy, it does show some advanced thinking in at least one area, but there are still some very major outstanding questions.
Let's step back. What controversy is this government in waiting causing?
Well, there are still ongoing disputes and discussions among the administration and then between the U.S. and its friends and allies about what the governance structure of a post-conflict Iraq should look like. So should it be a U.S. military occupation or a U.S. occupation of some kind? Should there be a U.N. role? Should it be turned over to Iraqis? And if so, which Iraqis and how soon? All of these questions are making it sort of unclear what the actual plans are. And will delay some of those plans being implemented, and I think we will likely see upcoming weeks and months of serious discussions between the U.S. and friends and allies and at the U.N. Before we can come to some terms of agreement about all these questions.
Well, those questions that you mentioned are pretty significant ones.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just talking about details. We're talking about some pretty foundational questions.
That's exactly right.
You also called for a significant role for the U.N., probably a leading role for the U.N., and that doesn't seem to be in accordance with what the administration is thinking right now. Do you think they have secret intentions of bringing the U.N. in, or they really want to run this as an American show?
It seems that at least in the interim they want to run it as an American show. What they want the UN to do still remains very unclear because they haven't articulated it yet, and I think they are still undecided about it. They have said they want the UN to play some role, and Colin Powell in Brussels today reiterated that, but said they hadn't quite decided what role the UN should play. So they're certain that they want the UN to play a role on the humanitarian side. I think the open question is still what further role they might play. At the same time, Britain is calling for the UN to play a role in choosing an Iraqi interim authority, something which I think the U.S. will be sort of reluctant about, but other European countries seem quite interested in that idea. So that is one of the sort of open major questions that we'll be dealing with in the next few weeks.
Do you think that Iraq can stay together as a country, or is it going to fracture according to ethnic and regional lines?
My sense and our sense here is that it will. Most experts tend to think that it will stay together as a country. You obviously have the Kurdish situation in the north, which is the major open question, and the Kurds in Iraq and elsewhere in the region have for a long time been calling for having their own independent state, and the Kurds currently under the structure in Iraq have a great deal of autonomy. But I think that it is felt that as long as a future government structure and political structure for Iraq could include some continuing measure of autonomy for the Kurds, that they will not seek to secede from Iraq. And most real experts on Iraq say that it does not have a major history of ethnic violence along the lines of, say, what we saw in the former Yugoslavia. And the kinds of ethnic violence that we have seen in Iraq tend to have been driven by the government itself. So although I think it's safe to assume some post-war violence in the sense of score settling and revenge violence, because you always see those in post-conflict situations, that sort of violence, it's not expected that this will devolve into a sort of civil war situation and a breakup of the country.
The Bush administration, well, during the presidential campaign and before September 11th, spoke scornfully of nation building, and of course now here they are having to do it. The precedent of Afghanistan is not terribly encouraging. The Afghan government is struggling to raise $200 million in domestic revenue. So do you think they have the heart and the intention to stick around, or are they going to just hope to walk out and wash their hands of everything?
Right. Well, of course, that's a question at the end of the day that only they can answer. I see some measure, I think we can take some measure of hope from a few facts. One, that the administration and the president himself has made some fairly far-reaching promises to the Iraqi people about what we intend to do there. And I also think there's a certain degree to which his presidency is staked on the success of this war and on the post-war effort. I think he is seen as being so involved and having made so many promises that it will be difficult in some sense to walk away from that. So that's what gives me some measure of hope. On the flip side, you have not only the past experiences like Afghanistan, as you mentioned, but we are also already seeing signs from the administration or statements from the administration about, for example, turning over to an Iraqi interim authority within a matter of 3 months, and by that time having built up the beginnings of democratic institutions in Iraq and that sort of thing. That's a wildly unrealistic time frame, and it doesn't bode well because it suggests that there will be some of the same pressures that we've seen in the past of pulling out before things are ready or not having the staying power. And I think it's also fair to say that the U.S. generally, the American public and the Congress, and in fact the international community, has a relatively short attention span for these issues, and we will move on to the next conflict and we will get donor fatigue and all of the rest of the things that we've seen in the past. And so for those reasons, I'm skeptical, but I do have to hope that because of the president's promises and because of the enormous stakes in the region for getting this right, that we will see more of a commitment than we have in the past.
Well, one difference between Afghanistan and Iraq is that Afghanistan barely had a state, and you know, Karzai now is sometimes referred to as the mayor of Kabul, but you know, there's certainly no complicated, deeply rooted state structure in Afghanistan the way there is in most other countries of the world. Iraq is quite the opposite. I mean, it has a very strong state, and there are very few alternative, if any, alternative centers of power or you know, alternative potential leaders. Saddam eliminated most of them. And, you know, the situation is not unlike that when the Soviet Union came to an end. You know, they took away this party and state structure that had dominated the society to the exclusion of most other forms of organization. What's going to happen when you take away that kind of structure?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think many commentators on this question, including us, feel quite strongly that, in fact, it will be good to try to decentralize power in Iraq, and that will be a first and very crucial step in seeing the kind of political development and civil society development and talent development on the political side that we will need to see in Iraq. There is, of course, you know, another worry for turning things over to an Iraqi interim authority too soon is that that will just mean a continuation of the highly centralized and sort of strongman figure structure that we have seen in Iraq up until now.
I saw an interview early in the war on MSNBC. There's an interview with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a former journalist turned petroleum consultant, saying that the only thing the United States can do is just find some other Saddam in the army and turn things over to him. Do you think that's likely?
It doesn't seem that it is likely at this point. It seems more likely that if we pick an Iraqi to turn power over to, it will be Ahmad Chalabi, who is the head of the Iraqi National Congress. I think there was some hope or some thought that perhaps an Iraqi military leader might emerge or we might see a coup with the 11th hour. We have not seen that yet, and I think precisely as you were saying, there is no other political talent, not political talent, there certainly is, but there are no obvious political leaders within the country, at least that we know of right now. Some might emerge quite quickly, but they have all been either heavily repressed or else killed or otherwise taken out by Saddam. So for now, it doesn't seem like there is that person there within the country, and that the administration seems to be focusing on the outside Iraq opposition.
I'm speaking with Bathsheba Crocker, who is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in D.C., and co-author of a report on post-conflict Iraq, planning for post-conflict Iraq. Now, what about legitimacy problems? The United States is talking about how it's moving in to liberate the people of Iraq. It's certainly not been welcomed as liberators so far. And here we are, we're talking about imposing, essentially, a democratic structure on a country that's not our own. I mean, how can you derive or develop any kind of legitimate government out of that arrangement?
Well, I think if we actually make some progress in setting up institutions that the Iraqis then themselves would have ownership over and would develop a process by which Iraqis would choose their own future leader and their own future government structure, that is a very different story from sort of imposing from the outside our model of democracy or somebody else's model of democracy and saying, hold elections in 3 months, okay, there you have a democracy and you know, we're all set and good to go. And it depends on what they're thinking about here. Our feeling and what we recommended in the report was, in fact, that we should instead think about setting up some sort of a process. And through that process, you could see civil society development, political development, democratization, and a sort of a selection of delegates who would then sit for some period of time and decide what the future government of Iraq should look like. I think it is fair to say that the United States should not dictate what that future government should look like.
And the $64 billion question, who's going to own the oil?
That is the $64 billion question, and it is not yet answered. The president has said that the Iraqi oil revenues will be used for the benefit of the Iraqi people, but what he appears to mean by that is that we will use it to pay for the reconstruction. Now, I think it's reasonable to think that that is for the benefit of the Iraqi people, but there are many people who are complaining about the idea of the U.S. dictating even that. And so I think we will see some fight about that. Our feeling has been that there needs to be an international oversight board with a heavy Iraqi involvement and a very transparent process, because the oil is obviously going to be a very contentious issue and one that I do not think the U.S. should have its fingerprints all over.
Well, the early signs, I mean, we've got, you know, Halliburton getting contracts for oil fires, and we've got the U.S. Imposing a U.S.-friendly cell phone standard on telecommunications in post-war Iraq. It looks like American oil companies are lining up for their share of the crude. I mean, it looks like they're just going to turn things over to U.S. corporations. And what we've seen in the last couple of weeks certainly give me every reason to believe this. Do you think they're going to change their mind and try to be a little more concerned about looking legitimate and not like conquerors stripping the country of its assets?
I certainly hope so. We haven't, although Halliburton did get a contract to fight the oil well fires, we haven't yet seen any U.S. companies get contracts for oil development. But there's no doubt that they will be lining up to get those contracts. There are companies who are lining up to get some of the other reconstruction contracts. And I certainly hope that the administration sees the benefit of offering those contracts to a wider range of companies than just U.S. companies. They have said that international companies can bid on the subcontracts under those major contracts, which is a start. But I think, again, in terms of transparency and legitimacy questions and dampening anti-American sentiment, it will be important to make sure that this is as international an effort as it can be.
One of the details in your report, paragraph or two, you say that it would be important to preserve Saddam's palaces and Ba'ath Party headquarters for the documents that are within there. And those are among the first things that the cruise missiles hit. So what do you think are the consequences of that?
Well, if we are hitting I can't argue with what are taken out as military targets, and if there is some reason to take those out as a military matter, then I think that's what should have been done. Our point was more that this was one other area, sort of preserving of documents and potential evidence was obviously one other area that they should be preparing for. Now, it may be that they don't think there's anything useful there. Maybe that they think stuff has already been taken out, or maybe that it was just important from the military front. I'm not really in a position to argue with that. But I do hope that there are plans in place, both with respect to finding the WMD, which I think there are at this point. That is an area where they have done some significant planning, and for other areas like preserving evidence of war crimes, as we've suggested in the report.
And finally, Iraq has a gigantic foreign debt, whether it's just borrowing, but also obligations left over from the last Gulf War, $383 billion, I believe you say in the report. What's going to be done with that?
Well, we need to think about a massive debt restructuring for Iraq and a moratorium on paying back Iraq's debt. And the UN also needs to address the question of claims related to the previous Gulf War, which is the bulk of that $383 billion figure. In settled claims, there's still $27 billion owed by Iraq. There are also $172 billion in unsettled claims. If Iraq has to pay this back and has to pay back the debt, there is no chance of getting the economy off its feet. And so people need to start, the countries that own the debt and the companies that own the debt and the countries that own the claims related to the previous Gulf War need to start doing some serious thinking about what they are willing to forgive or restructure, because that needs to happen quickly so that Iraq's money can be freed up as much as possible to pay for the humanitarian and reconstruction needs of the Iraqis and not to saddle the Iraqi people with debts and claims that were run up under Saddam's regime.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bathsheba Crocker is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., the report that we're referring to is available on the web at csis.org. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood, and we'll be back next week with more from the world of economics and politics. And let's go out with a little bit all the music in this program available at protest-records.com. And this is a little item from Cat Power. Until next week, goodbye.